The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to start with a quote, actually, from this book, Labor Rights or Civil Rights, Saragossa Vargas. He says this: in the early 1930s, communists played a major part in provoking the unrest among Mexican workers in the Southwest. Instructed to respond to the rising level of discontent, the Communist Party initiated strikes and demonstrations and set up cells and factories and mines in preparation for a future revolutionary upsurge. And he's speaking specifically about the role that the CP played in trying to organize the Mexican working class. So the thesis for my talk, it's a very big subject that I'm going to try to condense in some fairly general strokes. But the thesis is based on the following. Marxists have come to understand the centrality of the working class in the anti-capitalist transformation of society. In the U.S., Marxists learned that this required a direct confrontation with the most extreme forms of racial and sexual oppression and segregation. U.S. capitalism has been built on the capacity to use racism and racist violence to establish divisions within the working class. And for Marxists, overcoming those divisions is a prerequisite for building the kind of fight back necessary for the transformation of society. While the Communist Party in the early 30s, the Communist Party in the early 30s attempted to establish an analysis that facilitated the struggle, the specific struggle of the Mexican working class inside the United States. But it was really the self-activity of Mexican workers and Chicano workers, as we later came to be called, and the role specifically of Mexican and Chicano workers who became communists, who understood, not the theoretical formulations, but understood how to apply them in their own communities, that advanced the struggle the furthest, I would argue, in the 20th century, in terms of understanding the nature of the struggle and organizing the working class. I also want to advance the theory, which I won't get time to go into, but if you read Vargas' book, you'll get this in depth, which is that the civil rights movement, in essence, did not develop sort of outside of the workplace. The civil rights movement began at the point of production. And what I'll argue here is that the beginning processes of the civil rights movement began with communists, who essentially began to organize from the point of production into the communities overall. And lastly, my thesis is based on the idea that much of this history is hidden from us, but nevertheless remains very relevant for our struggles today, and in many ways continues to inform Marxism, the approach of Marxists. The political traditions of Mexicans in the United States, and I'm going to be focusing on Mexicanos and Chicanos, were shaped by several factors that ultimately led to a convergence with the Communist Party. So it's not to say that the Communist Party invented Mexican workers or Mexican worker struggle, but there was a convergence. It began with the period after the conquest of northern Mexico by the U.S., in which you had the rise of what came to be known as social banditry, individual forms of resistance against Anglo oppression. It continued with the anarcho-syndicalist traditions of Ricardo Flores Magón and the Magonista movement on the U.S.-Mexican border, the participation of many migrants who became migrants in the Mexican Revolution, filling the ranks of the Villista and Zapatista armies, and radicalized and politicized and bringing those experiences with them to the United States. It continued with the participation of migrant workers in brutal, brutal struggles in the fields and in the mines and in the railroads. So the Mexican struggle has a history that precedes the Communist Party, in many forms. But nevertheless, there's a convergence in which the Communist Party and Marxist politics become very relevant. Mexicans, whether citizens or not, also experience forms of Jim Crow segregation that marginalize them in the types of jobs that they got, where they were, within their jobs, what kind of positions they got, segregated housing and education, and of course marginalized from the political system. They also suffered from very specific forms of state violence that other groups didn't necessarily experience in the same way, such as the persecution associated with immigration and deportation, things that, of course, are still forms of state terrorism and oppression today. By the early 1930s, a generation of militant Mexican and Mexican-American workers was forged out of these struggles, especially in places where the Mexican community was concentrated, Los Angeles, San Antonio, Denver, other cities in the Southwest. These working class fighter intellectuals rejected the politics of the dominant politics of the Mexican community at that time, the 1920s, the politics of the small but influential Mexican-American middle class, which stressed at that time political conservatism, assimilation, and the sort of separation of oneself from the migrant population as a means to present to the sort of conservative American political system a willingness to forego one's roots, one's culture, in order to fit in. Of course, this model never worked. But nevertheless, it was the dominant politics expressed by groups such as the LULA, the League of United Latin American Citizens, predominantly Mexicans who didn't want to call themselves Mexicans. They said, we were Latin Americans. At that time, it meant Latin being of Latino descent and American being of the US. A significant number of these militants are going to later join the Communist Party once they came in contact. So many of these politics, these class struggle sort of orientations were already developed, but it was the presence of an organization now that was giving expression to them that led many of these militants to join the Communist Party. As one person put it, the only organization attempting to do something immediately about jobs, relief, and the general welfare of our people, who have been largely ignored by other political forces. Many of the leaders joined the party through participation in the formation of CIO-aligned unions, especially those where the Communist Party had membership or influence, and in regions, again, where Mexicans were concentrated. These unions were the crucibles of class struggle and also provided the memberships and financial support for the radical efforts, civil rights organizing. Okay, so I'm not going to have time to go through a lot of these things, so I'm going to focus on some very specific things. I want to talk about the Communist Party's perspective on race, which deserves its own discussion because it changed a lot. But nevertheless, there were some high points that really we should focus on. The party's position on racism in the 1930s, with the lead of the Communist International, the Communist Party broke with the previously dominant sort of radical position on race, which was held by the Socialist Party, which was the dominant left party in this country before the Communist Party, which stated that racism was merely an extension of class and should not be approached as a separate issue. By fighting the class struggle, ultimately that will subsume the racial oppression. So they recognize that racial oppression exists, but it was a distraction from the larger struggle. So the Communist Party began with a recognition of the special character of racial oppression, largely focusing on black oppression, which was the party's main focus. Even though this is going to be extended to Mexican workers, although, as I'm going to point out, with much less clarity and development. The CP was the first U.S. Marxist organization to recognize the special condition and to elaborate a strategy that required socialists to champion the fight, not just against the oppression at the point of production, but a fight against their legal, political, economic, and social oppression, the special oppression. Through the 1930s, the Communist Party used this platform as a means to organize a range of struggles on a national scale. Specifically, looking at the African Americans, there's a lot of recent literature, and I say recent in the last 20 years, that really goes into this. From the book Hammer and Hoe, the book Communists in Harlem during the Depression, there's another book, Defying Dixie. Great books that really show the role of the CP in the sort of fight against racial oppression of African Americans. While the orientation towards organizing Mexican workers was given less focus, the recruitment of a layer of Mexican-American cadre, a small but very significant number, the Communist Party was able to recruit people like Emma Tenayuca and others, individuals who didn't represent a mass recruitment, but represented the recruitment of individuals who had mass followings, who were able to organize and lead masses of people. And this is very significant, what these people were able to accomplish, even with the sort of, what I'll show you, demonstrate is the vacillating politics of the Communist Party. And so it's the recruitment, it's the implementation of the strategy of confronting racism, recruiting a layer of of Mexican-American cadre and the role of that Mexican-American cadre that's going to really extend the struggle for civil rights and lead to the development of a Mexican Marxist left in this country that we have yet to see, you know, substantially rebuilt. Okay, so I'm going to focus on a couple ways in which the CP put this into practice. One is it's not a direct thing, but it's something that led the CP to come into contact with a lot of Mexican workers, which is to say that in 1928, between 1929 and 1935, the position of the Communist Party at that time, known as its third period, I'm not going to get too much into this, except to say that a faulty formulation was that that revolution was on the agenda and that communists needed to build communist-led unions that paralleled the existing AFL unions. Now, this was something that led to the formation of a lot of unions on paper, and where there was an attempt to really build an alternative to the AFL, it failed miserably. And again, I won't go into that. But this approach also recognized the need to organize black workers and Mexican workers. And the results of this are going to be mixed, but it's very significant to understand that the Communist Party is going to be the first in many parts of the Southwest to directly try to organize Mexican workers, you know, using the sort of racial oppression formulation and the third period need to organize separate unions. The fact that there weren't unions opened the field to the communists. Okay, and the fact that the communists were willing to fight racial oppression as a component of the class struggle brought them into contact with Mexican workers on a larger scale. Okay. One of the first efforts in California was the formation of something called the Cannery and Agricultural Workers Industrial Union. In 1933, there was a strike wave in California agriculture. Keep in mind, this is 30 years plus before the United Farm Workers Movement. 37 strikes occurred this year involving over 50,000 workers and covering 65% of the state crops. The majority of the workers were Mexican nationals who were migrants or who had established residency in the United States, and Mexican Americans, people with citizenship. Groups largely ignored by the AFL, and in fact the AFL had largely abandoned trying to organize agricultural workers by this year. The largest of the strikes, the cotton strike, involved 18,000 workers. 75, the numbers are based on the research, there's a range, 75 to 95% which were Mexican workers, and extended over 100 square miles between four counties. Efforts to organize these militant workers, and again, I want to emphasize that workers were beginning to take these actions on their own. The CP helped to organize it, you know, and coordinate it. The CAWIU decided to try to organize these workers in the strike wave. They sent six communists to organize these thousands of workers. Six communists into four counties to try to give some sort of collective union organization. Wow. It was, as you can guess, it was a shoestring operation. But the dedication of the organizers and the political will to fight amongst the Mexican workers at that time drew them together, drew broad support from the Mexican workers, like I said, who were already self-organizing and striking. After the first smaller victories of this strike wave, which I'll talk about the specific number of victories in a minute, delegations of farm workers began to flock to the unions. A victory, right, is significant, especially in an environment where it was very difficult to win. As one CP organizer described after the first efforts, he says this: word spread that there was something that agricultural workers could do to better their condition. Individual workers came into the union headquarters, and delegations came in from the ranches, and we advised them to organize, which they did. They organized locals in tents and hovels and holes in the wall. Strikers who had taken part in one of the largest strikes formed the nucleus. So the people who were victorious in the smaller strikes began to be the basis for organizing for the next strikes. The strike cry began to ring through the valley. Not a pound for less than $1 a hundred, which basically was a demand saying for each 100 pounds of cotton we pick, we're not going to be paid less than a dollar. And at that, prior to the strike wave, they were being paid 50 to 60 cents. So within a very short period of time, the Communist Party slogans, you know, are beginning to sort of resonate. Of the 37 strikes that year, 29 resulted in gains and wage increases. despite brutal resistance by the growers. If you read the book Factory in the Fields by Kerry McWilliams, and I reference it in No One is Illegal, he describes the sort of level of organization and repression of agricultural strikes as he called it farm fascism, because literally armed violence would be used to kill people, you know, in the context of trying to organize a union. It was a semi-feudal sort of, and in many ways continues to be, you know, even to this day, you know, where growers exercise, they control large quantities of land and they exercise a lot of power over local political systems. Nevertheless, these victories were obtained. The struggle helped coalesce a layer of militant workers whose experience elevated them to leadership within the farm worker movement and who became politically aware of the larger struggle in which they were a part. An estimated 7,000 farm workers joined the CAWIU by the end of that year. And a new layer of Mexicano and Mexican Americans joined the party. They joined branches in these small agricultural communities. Not in mass numbers, but the militants who were becoming conscious of their own power began to see the Communist Party as a way forward. So for instance, if you're not from California, this won't, even if you're from California, you probably never heard of these places. Tulare, Brawley, you know, these agricultural regions, very conservative, red state within the within California places. You know, the party literature or the internal documents, according to the research, begin to show that, you know, 10 or 15 agricultural workers would join, and then, you know, over time, the party actually had a sort of base in these agricultural regions. Rushing ahead, within a very short period of time, the Communist Party shifted gears away from forming dual unions and basically abandoned the strategy altogether of organizing farm workers in this capacity. And instead, later on, shifted to something called the Popular Front, which emphasized re-entry into the AFL, and then later on the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. So a quick change in strategy, you know, shifted away from this orientation. But many of the communists that were veterans of the CAWIU struggle later on went to help form the another union. I always get this acronym screwed up. UCAPAWA, and of course I didn't write it down. Union of Cannery and Agriculture Packing House Workers and Allied Workers of America. UCAPAWA. Which consequently went on to become the second largest CIU affiliated union in the country prior to its joining with the AFL in 1955. UCAPAWA, and I'll say a few things about this union because it's very significant, attempted to organize agricultural farm workers as well as an industrial union, as well as packing house, canning, and processing workers. The agricultural side of the work was very unsuccessful. I won't go into that. But the canning workers and the food processing workers was very significant. By the late 1930s, a quarter of all Mexican women, for instance, 25% of all Mexicanas, the Mexican-American women in Los Angeles worked in canneries, including my great-grandmother, or the garment sector. So there was a division of labor within agriculture in which the men typically worked in the field and the women typically worked in the other side of it, the packing or the canning. By 1939, 75,000 women worked in California canneries. A significant percentage of these in places like Los Angeles, the majority being Mexican women. Excuse me, 75,000 women in California, and that 75,000 made up 75% of all canning workers, so the majority being women. Consequently, this segment of the food production population in California was 25% of the whole nationwide food processing population. So this is a very significantly placed population of Mexican women. who are going to go on to become very significant in the formation of this union. The national leadership that's formed, the UCAPAWA, involves many of the veterans, female veterans in particular, of the previous Communist Party-led CAWIU. In fact, seven of the women of the UCAPAWA's national leadership, seven national leaders, were female communists, including a very significant woman by the name of Luisa Moreno. I'm not going to have a lot of time to go into the story of Luisa Moreno, but I feel obligated to say that this individual woman played such a role in building this union that if she weren't a woman, if she weren't, she's Guatemalan actually, of Guatemalan descent, and if she weren't a communist, we would be celebrating her as somebody similar to the way that we celebrate Cesar Chavez today. But because of who she was and at the time in which she operated and her political perspectives, most people have never heard of her. Okay, thanks. UCA power revolutionized agricultural struggle in various ways. And many of these things we're going to later associate with the UFW, United Farm Workers, which is not to take away from what the United Farm Workers did. But it's to understand that they didn't invent many of the tactics that they use. Actually, the communist organizers did, right? And the people in struggle themselves. UCA power understood that agriculture was this sort of fiefdom of this powerful class of landowners who exploited racial divisions in order to keep farm worker groups separate. So UCA power emphasized a radical organizing orientation, understanding that, for instance, in California, the the agricultural labor force consisted of primarily Mexicans, Filipinos, and Japanese, and then in other places, African Americans. Their primary strategy was recruiting organizers from those ethnic groups. Okay, and also organizing and promoting women organizers. They also emphasized racial, gender, and religious solidarity as a key component of organizing. So organizers were essentially trained to take this kind of approach to their organizing, combating gender, sexual oppression, racial bigotry, and even religious chauvinism, all of which were used as levers to keep this agricultural workforce very divided and weak. In the process, interestingly enough, this won many poor whites. You know, there was a lot of difficulty organizing white and workers of color in this period. Dorothy Healy, who was a Communist Party organizer who went through all these struggles and was part of this process, herself an Anglo-American, commented in her memoirs when she was talking about this. She said that the strategy of UCA power had so much success, she says, that I could watch the disappearance or at least the diminishing of bigotry. She says, watching all those Okies and Arkies, these poor Midwestern migrants who came to California, she says, in the process of a strike, how they soon saw that the white cops who were beating them were their enemies, and that the black and the Chicano workers were their brothers. Right? So this was something that she began to observe in the 1930s. Within UCA power, women organizers and leadership were consciously developed as a means to address their specific conditions. Women held 40% of all shop steward positions in the union and 20% of national leadership posts. Taking the CP's Mexican question approach, UCA power organized migrant and undocumented workers alongside citizens and residents and fervently opposed immigration enforcement and policies and the deportation policies of the 1930s. Predating their successful use by later United Farm Workers when the UCA power went on strike, when workers went on strike, they would organize secondary boycotts. They would send pickets to grocery stores that were selling scab food, something that became very important to the United Farm Workers' struggle as a social movement. And so they would build a sort of opposition and a sense of solidarity from the field to the canning, from the packing house to the grocery store. They would organize public protests at the homes of individual growers, something that became sort of a tactic of the Occupy movement, right? Going to the bankers' houses. Well, the UCA power was doing this in the 30s. They would find out where these growers live, and they would send the women picketers with their children, typically, to call attention to these rich growers and what they were doing to these, in the case of the canning workers, how they were underpaying them and creating these conditions of poverty. There were kids would carry signs saying I'm underfed because my mommy's underpaid, right? And then the news would come because this would be in like Bel Air or some rich part of town, and here come all these Mexican families. It was very upsetting. At one picket at a grocery store, when a group of Teamsters didn't honor the picket line, and I'm quoting here from Vicky Ruiz, who really, you know, wrote, did the research on this. She says, Mexican union women members became so incensed that they climbed onto the loading platform and quickly de-pantsed a group of surprised and embarrassed teamsters. at which time the rest of the teamster stopped. And perhaps most significant of the Ukapawa union was that their contracts, because of this power they exercised in food processing and their militancy and their political orientation, their contracts were considered some of the most advanced at the time. By 1946, 66% of contracts contained equal pay for equal clauses in their contracts, equal pay for equal work for women and men. 75% allowed for leaves of absence without loss of seniority. So if a woman had a baby, she wouldn't essentially be fired or removed to the back of the line. 80% contained paid vacations and nighttime and weekend pay increases. And perhaps not as significant, but as more meaningful, Luisa Moreno was very detail-oriented, and she required that all of the contracts were bilingual, and that each contract that was written with the Ukapawa required that men and women were listed in the contract. Not just men, but men and women. Or if it was an all-women workforce, women. Because the tendency was to even to ignore women in the language. By its second convention in 1937, Ukapawa claimed 371 locals and a membership of 124,000, of which half were women and mostly Mexican as far as the cannery workers go. How much time do I have?
You got like 10 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to skip over. I was going to talk about the National Miners Union, which is very significant, but I'm running out of time, so I'll skip forward. Okay, I want to then devote the rest of my time to talking about civil rights extending from the point of production into the community. And I want to start by going back to this person I mentioned, Emma Tenayuca. Emma Tenayuca was a working class Mexicana Tejana from Texas, who by 16, began to sort of understand the dynamics of the class struggle in San Antonio, where her family members worked in the pecan shelling industry, along with thousands of other Mexican women, and they were some of the lowest paid workers in the country. And by 16, she was trying to help organize them into unions. And as she explained it, the Communist Party showed up one day, the next day I was a communist. Emma Tenayuca and Homer Brooks, who became her husband, they took this sort of concept of the Communist Party and tried to elaborate it into something more specific, a way of understanding the centrality of the struggle for Mexican rights in the United States. And they published in the Communist journal, The Communist, something that they referred to as the Mexican question. And this is very important because I don't think that any of us really have studied this, but it is something that informs much of the way that we operate as Marxists today. She said, all Mexicans north of the border are one people. Political unity between Mexican Americans and Mexican nationals is essential. Mexicans are a conquered people because of the nature in which their lands were taken from them and which racial segregation and Jim Crow were imposed upon them. I'm paraphrasing some of this. She says, but they're not. They do not constitute a separate nation. She says, the interests of Mexican and Mexican-American workers are bound up with the larger working class. Although their conquered status creates the basis for a second form of racial oppression as well. She says, the task now is to build a democratic front among the Mexican masses by unifying them on the basis of specific needs. So in a way, she's attempting to try to push the party to then allocate resources now to confronting the racial oppression that Mexicans experience as they have been doing with the African Americans. And this laid the basis for articulating a fight against the special oppression, as I mentioned, from the point of production now to other forms of struggle. And this led to the formation of something called El Congreso del Pueblo de Habla Española, the Spanish-speaking People's Congress, which was formed in 1938 by Communist Party members in Los Angeles. Some of whom were veterans of the struggles that I previously mentioned. The intention of the Congress was to mobilize the Latino community in direct active struggle for civil rights and other things. such as build unity behind the CIO as it was rising, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. The approach would be the popular front method, which was broad unity amongst progressive forces, which was a formulation of the CP that led them into serious problems, because it basically was a dictate that was meant to align the CP with the policies of the Soviet Union, then thoroughly Stalinized, which basically saw communist parties around the world as supporting Soviet foreign policy, which was non-revolutionary and basically directed to try to support the stabilization and the consolidation of the Stalinist ruling class in Russia. Okay. I didn't mean to go there, but I started running my mouth. And okay. So what I want to emphasize is that even though this idea of the Popular Front, the Congreso Popular Front, was to sort of unite liberals and progressive forces with, you know, with the working class in general, or the Mexican working class in general, in reality, the greatest success of the Congreso was its ability to actually mobilize thousands of Mexican and Mexican-American working class people in direct fights against oppression. Okay. Through the effective organizing efforts of these organizers, they were able to build broad support behind the effort, behind their efforts. At their first convocation in Los Angeles, they brought together 88 delegates representing 73 Mexican-American and Mexicano organizations, representing a total organizational membership of 70,000 people in Los Angeles. At their first national convention in 1939, over 1,500 people attended over the course of several days of Congress deliberations. 137 delegates representing 105 national organizations with a combined membership of 1 million constructed a charter to launch the sort of program of the Congreso. Now, this is significant. It doesn't mean suddenly they're mobilizing a million people, but they were able to sort of begin to build a broad front that in many ways represented a lot of genuine Mexican and Mexican-American communities in different parts of the Southwest. Taking its cue from Tenayuca's thesis on the Mexican question, the Congreso identified its main goal as, like I said, uniting the Latin, Mexicano masses, broad Latino masses, documented or undocumented, into a national civil rights struggle. And so I'm going to focus on a few things that they did, because this is very, very significant. Between 1939 and 1942, they began to implement this full project. And in this three-year period, it gives us a glimpse of what really we can understand is the beginning of the Chicano movement. And if it continued, would have advanced that Chicano movement by 20 years. But we're, as I'm going to point out, unfortunately, the Communist Party pulled the plug on it. Their program called for the desegregation in housing in Los Angeles and in all neighborhoods, and rent controls. They organized boycotts of businesses that didn't hire African Americans or Mexicans, in which they would send pickets to basically call on the community not to cross these picket lines and shop here. They set up, because of the in this convention, there was a lot of community members identified police brutality and police racism as a major problem. They organized cop watch committees to be rooted in the communities around Los Angeles and in the other communities in which they set up chapters like San Diego, and emergency response networks to police brutality. They set up a prisoners' rights network in which Congreso members would go and form relationships with people in prison, Mexicanos in prison, in order to advocate for their rights, to make sure that all the documentation that they were, you know, relating to their cases was either published in Spanish or translated to them, and to agitate around prison conditions. They promoted in all of their literature and in their activism equal pay for equal work. They had an affirmative action program within the Congreso which promoted women to leadership positions and advocated for full rights for women. The Congreso was the first active immigrant rights organization. They built a statewide campaign in response to something called the Swing Bill, which is implemented in 1939, which called for the purging of undocumented Mexican migrants from relief rolls if they had not applied for citizenship. The Congreso organized a mass march of 20,000, which convened on the Capitol after the bill passed both houses of the state legislature. Faced with a massive demonstration, and these kinds of things weren't as common then as they are today, you know, getting 20,000 people. Faced with a massive demonstration, then Governor Colbert Olson met with the representative of Congreso, Josefina Fiero de Bright, and in front of her agreed that he would veto the legislation. And she said, that would be great if you would do that in front of me. So we signed the veto in front of her, and then she said, could you please come tell the people? At which point, he proceeded to exit the Capitol and announce to 20,000 people that he was vetoing the legislation. I gotta wrap up here. The other aspect, which is there's very little known about the Congreso, was an actual formulation on cultural oppression. And they said this, and I'm quoting, the cultural heritage of the Spanish-speaking people is part of the common heritage of the American people as a whole, and should be preserved and expanded for the common benefit of all American people. The Congress articulated a program around cultural studies. They rejected assimilation as a racist project and promoted cultural pride and pluralism as a form of democratic expression. Their program called for bilingual education in K-12 public schools and the teaching of what they called Latin American history at all levels, and specifically Latin American history to parallel what they identified as European American history. They called for cultural studies institutes or special schools in which non-Latino people would be educated about the culture of Spanish-speaking peoples. They called for greater public input over textbook selection, criticizing that textbooks typically were racist or excluded Latinos from the curriculum. They organized dance and art schools, which was designed to promote cultural awareness amongst Latino youth. And anticipating ethnic studies and what I teach, Chicano studies, 60 years before it developed in San Diego, they called for a reform of higher education. Considering how few Latinos were actually allowed into higher education, it's a very revolutionary concept. They said, and I quote, there should be the formation of academic departments in colleges and universities to study the history, the culture, and society of the Spanish-speaking people through the Americas. The historian Mario T. Garcia asserts that this created the template for the later Chicano student movement. One of their last acts before their organization was folded in 1942 was to begin to organize against the Bracero program. Now, for roughly 3 years, they did organize on these fronts, and I'm not going to go through the victories, but there were some very tangible victories that took place. But with the outbreak of World War II, the Communist Party shifted its approach, pulled back from organizing around civil rights, and instead emphasized building national unity behind the war effort. Communist Party members argued that civil rights organizing would embarrass the allied U.S. government at a time of war against Hitler and discourage Mexican-American enlistment in the war. Consequently, what they ended up doing was driving a lot of the great Chicano leaders out of the party, even though some of them held their nose and swallowed their whatever pride and continued organizing. Okay, and I have to wrap up. What I didn't talk about, right?
Yeah, 3 minutes.
Okay, 3 minutes. Okay, well let me expand just for a moment on this, because the story doesn't end there. In 1948, Mexican American activists within the Communist Party in Los Angeles at that time made a major push to get Mexican American civil rights back on the agenda. At a party conference in 1948, a renewed emphasis was placed on organizing again within the Mexican community. The Communist Party passed something called the Resolution on Party Work Among the Mexican People, which elaborated a national strategy for recruiting Mexican American workers, including printing literature in Spanish, developing leadership training schools for Mexican Americans, increasing the struggle against police brutality, and a nationwide campaign against deportation. An estimated 2,000 militants, many of whom were from CIO unions, many of whom were communists, mostly Mexican Americans, formed the backbone of this effort, this renewed effort. Built on the formulations of the Congreso, it actually went further, reflecting the new challenges of the day. It linked the oppression of Mexican Americans in the United States to the imperial oppression of the United States over Mexico. It actually drew larger international conclusions about the dimensions of oppression. It opposed the Cold War, called for nuclear disarmament. Now, of course, part of this was a reflection of Soviet foreign policy, since those nuclear missiles were pointing at the Soviet Union. But nevertheless, it was one of the first articulations of opposition to nuclear weaponry in the United States. And organized a national significant anti-war campaign against the Korean War. A lot of people don't know, but public opinion against the Korean War at its height was about 55% against the war. And part of this had to do with a very little known anti-war movement. Again, the historian Mario T. Garcia explains that these organizing efforts played a very significant role in helping to turn, later in the next war, the Vietnam War, helping to shift Mexican-American opinion against the war, which was a very significant aspect of ending the war. Mm-hmm. Okay, it was dissolved, these efforts were dissolved in the 1950s because the CP, under a lot of attack during the McCarthyite period, retreated from a lot of their front groups, lost a lot of membership, couldn't sustain this type of organizing, and because many of the best militants in this new renewed organization, I forgot to mention the name, the Asociación Nacional Mexicano-Americano, many of them were deported, hounded by immigration authorities, and basically had their lives ruined, in various ways by repression. And so, in conclusion, I tried to focus on some of the highlights of the sort of Marxist influence, sort of orientation towards the Mexican question in this country. I didn't have time to go over everything. I'll come back in my wrap-up and sort of make some of the concluding statements. But I just want to finish by saying this history is very significant because it helps frame, in part, the understanding of the sort of architecture of the Chicano movement, which was the next wave of uprising in the community. And because of the attack on this sort of history of the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and of Mexicans in this country as well, much of this history has been suppressed. We need to reclaim these traditions. We need to learn this history. We need to understand it because much of it continues to provide a guide for us today. And by building on it, we can confront the issues that continue to affect the Mexican and Latino community today as a whole. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.